The professionals have fought back, revealing more and more of how the intelligence was manipulated. Using his sources inside the agency, Risen reveals that agency officials actually made serious attempts to get Iraq right. For instance, the agency tracked down some 30 overseas relatives of Iraqi scientists thought to be involved with weapons of mass destruction. The relatives agreed to go to Iraq and try to have private conversations with those scientists. All came back with the same report. Saddam Hussein's WMD programs had been shut down since the end of the first Gulf War. But none of it ever made its way out of the bowels of the agency. Instead, top administration officials chose to believe Iraqi exiles such as the infamous Curveball and his claims about mobile bioweapons labs cruising the Iraqi desert, despite repeated warnings from senior CIA officials that he was almost certainly a fabricator. The book's other chapters are filled with similar stories from disgruntled spooks who believe the war on terrorism has been badly mishandled from the outset. Such criticisms will not surprise the agency's many neoconservative detractors, who see it as too hidebound by timidity and bureaucratic inertia to operate in a war in which the old rule books no longer apply. Risen acknowledges the national security bureaucracy is, quote, maddeningly slow, lacks creativity, and is risk-averse, unquote, but it has, he writes, one great virtue. Quote, it tends to weed out really stupid or dangerous ideas, unethical and even immoral ideas, ideas that could get people killed, unquote. Well, we'll see what happens, because when one turns to the subject of Grover Norquist, the people he represents, and the absolutely decisive position of power that he holds in Washington, D.C., well, let's just say we don't see too much being weeded out vis-a-vis Grover Norquist. We'll talk more about that later. What we're going to do now is we're going to review a section of a book that we've used many times on this program. That book is The Secret War Against the Jews, co-authored by John Loftus and Mark Ahrens. The book is subtitled How Western Espionage Betrayed the Jewish People. And specifically, what we're going to be taking a look at is something that places the NSA warrantless wiretapping flap in perspective, as we're going to see, and as we've seen in our past discussions of this, of the relationship between the NSA and the GCHQ of the United Kingdom. In fact, warrantless wiretapping has been going on as literally standard operating procedure for more than half a century, and specifically the United States and the United Kingdom, as well as related members of the British Commonwealth, such as Canada and Australia, have been conducting warrantless and widespread electronic surveillance, including wiretapping, for each other in each other's native countries for decades. Specifically, although it may be technically illegal for NSA or other U.S. intelligence agencies to conduct warrantless wiretapping, it isn't illegal for British agents to conduct warrantless wiretapping on Americans, and it isn't illegal for Americans to be conducting warrantless wiretapping on British citizens. And so basically, for decades, that is exactly what has happened. If the U.S. wants to monitor somebody and doesn't want to go through the niceties required to get official sanction, they simply turn to the British, who then gather the requisite information and pass it along. We do the same thing for the British. Now, in the discussion which is to follow, this is not necessarily to advance a ringing endorsement of this particular arrangement, but it is rather to give us some perspective, because as we have seen in our past discussions of this dynamic, and as we're going to see in our review of this dynamic, warrantless wiretapping has literally been business as usual. So why are we suddenly seeing all these people going there shocked to learn that there is gambling going on in this establishment, of course, parroting the famous words of Louis Renault, the police chief in Casablanca. And again, I think in that Edward Alden column, we are seeing the reason. Basically, there are elements within the national security establishment, within the military intelligence community and State Department, who are fighting back against the Bush administration's abuses. And also there are elements in the United Kingdom, I think, that are deeply alienated from the Bush administration and they too are bucking an even more formidable barrier to disclosure, the British Official Secrets Act, and we're seeing things like the Downing Street memo coming out, and as we're going to see, there's been another damaging disclosure in the United Kingdom about the Bush administration and its road to war. But what we're about to do is to review the NSA GCHQ liaison, and we're going to see just how extensive the warrantless electronic surveillance programs have been, and how extensive they have been for a long period of time, more than half a century. This, again, in order to understand why some questions should be asked about why we're seeing all of these disclosures. Warrantless wiretapping is business as usual. The reason why we're seeing this flap about it is, in all probability, due to a Watergate-like dynamic. There are elements in the intelligence community who are using this in order to basically strike back at the Bush administration for what it's done. Turning now to The Secret War Against the Jews by John Loftus and Mark Ahrens. By the way, the reference to old spies here is to a group of veteran intelligence agents from the retired intelligence agents from the U.S., the United Kingdom, the former Soviet Union, and Israel, who've given the authors a great deal of information about some of the past abuses of the intelligence community. One of the things that we're going to see here, by the way, is the fact that due to a number of elements of paranoia within the intelligence community, any Jew who is supportive of Israel gets spied on. Far from the official support of Israel that is maintained in this country, in fact, due to the fact that the Arabs have oil and Israel doesn't, and due to the close relationship between the intelligence community, the national security establishment, and petroleum producers, in fact, Israel has always been viewed with great suspicion, despite the official support. And so that is the genesis of what we're going to see as the Jew Room, one of the more striking aspects of the NSA-GCHQ liaison. But again, note that warrantless wiretapping by the NSA is literally business as usual. It has been from the get-go, so why the flap? Turning to Secret War Against the Jews. According to several of the old spies who worked in communications intelligence, the NSA headquarters is also the chief British espionage base in the United States. The presence of British wiretappers at the keyboards of American eavesdropping computers is a closely guarded secret, one that very few people in the intelligence community have been aware of, but it's true. An American historian, David Kahn, first stumbled onto a corner of the British connection in 1966 while writing his book, The Codebreakers. One indication of just how sensitive this information is considered on both sides of the Atlantic, is the fact that Kahn's publishers in New York and London were put under enormous pressure to censor a great deal of the book. In the main, Kahn simply revealed the existence of the liaison relationship, but when he wrote that the NSA and its British equivalent, the Government Communications Headquarters, quote, exchange personnel on a temporary basis, unquote, he had come too close to revealing the truth. The U.S. government told Kahn to hide the existence of British electronic spies from the American public. Kahn eventually agreed to delete a few of the most sensitive paragraphs describing the exchange of codes, techniques, and personnel with the British government. His innocuous few sentences threatened to disclose a larger truth, however. By the 1960s, the temporary, unquote, British personnel at Fort Meade had become a permanent fixture. The British enjoyed continued success to the greatest listening post in the world. The NSA is a giant vacuum cleaner. It sucks in every form of electronic information from telephone calls to telegrams across the United States. The presence of British personnel is essential for the American wiretappers to claim plausible deniability. Then Loftus and Ahrens go on to describe the specifics of how this relationship works. Continuing, here is how the game is played. The British liaison officer at Fort Meade types the target list of suspects, unquote, into the American computer. The NSA computer sorts through its wiretaps and gives the British officer the recording of any American citizen he wants. Since it is technically a British target of surveillance, no American search warrant is necessary. The British officer then simply hands the results over to his American liaison officer. Of course, the Americans provide the same service to the British in return. All international and domestic telephone calls in Great Britain are run through the NSA station in the British Government Communication Headquarters, or GCHQ, at Menwith Hill, which allows the American liaison officer to spy on any British citizen without a warrant. According to our sources, this duplicitous, reciprocal arrangement disguises the most massive and illegal domestic espionage apparatus in the world. Not even the Soviets could touch the UK-US intercept technology. Through this charade, the intelligence services of each country can claim that they are not targeting their own citizens. The targeting is done by an authorized foreign agent, the intelligence liaison resident in Britain or the United States. Thus, in 1977, during an investigation by the House Government Operations Committee, Admiral Bobby Inman could claim with a straight face that, quote, "There are no U.S. citizens now targeted by the NSA in the United States or abroad. None," unquote. Since the targeting was done not by NSA, but by employees of British GCHQ, he was telling the literal truth. Still, the congressional staff knew enough at the time to characterize Inman's statement in an unpublished report as, quote, "misleading," unquote. Whether Inman had personal knowledge of the British wiretapping may never be resolved. None of our sources claims to be present on any occasion when Admiral Inman met with the British liaison officers. It should be noted, however, that before Inman started his career with naval intelligence, he was assigned as an aide to London. The British connection may explain not only Inman's meteoric rise to become the youngest director of the NSA, but also why President Reagan later selected him to become William Casey's deputy at the CIA. The move surprised many who knew of Inman's reputation as a reformer and do-gooder. In fact, it was Admiral Inman who pulled the plug on the NSA's infamous Task Force 157 while he was at CIA. It is entirely possible that Inman may have been an innocent man whose public reputation for integrity was used for window dressing. Inman's supporters in the NSA, of whom he has many, suggest that the blame for the British wiretap connection rests entirely with the FBI, and that the NSA's job was only to carry out a targeting policy instituted by J. Edgar Hoover. That begs the question of whether Inman knew about the British targeting when he gave his misleading statement to Congress. Whether Inman had personal knowledge of the origins or extent of British domestic espionage or not, the old spies, several of whom served at Fort Meade, say that his denial of domestic targeting by the NSA is all semantic bull s blank blank blank, unquote. It is well known, even among low-ranking NSA employees, that the foreign liaison officers exchange all the targeting information anyway, including the names on the British target lists. Admiral Inman did not provide that information to Congress, although it was clearly relevant to its inquiries. According to a former special agent of the FBI, the "you spy on mine, I'll spy on yours" has been extended to the other Western partners, particularly Canada and Australia. We're going to continue with this analysis inside two of the program. As I mentioned at the beginning, I can't encourage listeners strongly enough to take advantage of the vast and steadily growing amount of information on the Spitfire website and on linked websites. I turn each For the Record program into a long, article-length written description. Those are available on the Spitfire website. A listener turns those into pieces for a blog sphere as well. There are also lectures available on the Spitfire website. There is a link to a website that has all of the declassified government documents about the Bush family's involvement with Nazi industry. There is a search function on the Spitfire website, links to a number of vital websites maintained by the heroic sister station, WFMU, which is not only archiving the entire For the Record series on Real Audio and MP3, but is also podcasting the For the Record series to people's iPods as well. So take advantage of those websites, and please take advantage not only of the dozen or so old anti-fascist books, more than 50 years old, that are available for download for free on compact PDF files, but also some written descriptions that I've spent a lot of time and effort on. When, for example, in the second half of the broadcast, I talk about Grover Norquist as part of a fifth column movement in the United States, gaining an understanding of the history and methodology of fascism is certainly useful, if not essential, for understanding what I'm driving at when I talk about a fifth column. So please